You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Okay, hello Pagoda! Hi! Is everybody having a lovely Greenbelt? Yeah, good. It's so lovely to see you all, and I'm so glad you've all chosen to spend a chunk of your Saturday evening in here with us. One of the lovely things about Greenbelt is that you can have so many beautiful new things, like the new venues. We've got the new Fly Zone this year, which is awesome. New speakers and new artists that you'll get to see. And one of the equally as lovely things is that you know you will come back to this home and there will be things that are still here and you'll be just so chuffed to see them after a year. And I know that things like the tiny tea tent, it's gorgeous. And I walked past it earlier and the waft of teas, it's delicious. The noodle bar is always here and always excellent. John Bell, always here and always excellent. I think the noodle bar, right, not as good as John Bell, I feel. He's not in here this year. And the Playhouse, iconic venues like that. I remember when the Playhouse was first introduced and how gorgeous to see those peaks every year. And I think our next two people that are about to come onto the stage are always here and... always so glad to see them. They're always... always well-dressed, I was going with. Always well-dressed. And really, if you are here, you know exactly who they are and they need no introduction. So I'm going to ask you... We did this the other day and it was really good. You're section one. All of you are section two, you onwards are section three. We're going gentle applause, rapturous, deafening, please. Okay, so I'm going to start over here, and after that, we will welcome Kate and Cole to the stage. So please over here, give me some gentle, polite, I love it. Going up to rapturous, deafening applause for Kate Butley and Cole Morton.
That was nice, wasn't it? That's Sophie. She's good, isn't she? Let's hear it for Sophie. Oh. Right. Who are you?
I feel like I'm at like the doctor's or something. So what seems to be the trouble? I always think it's funny when doctors go, "How are you?" Well, obviously not well. That's why I'm here.
It's great. They were saying, "Have you prepped much?" Conversation with Kate Butley. Here's Kate Butley. 45 minutes later, there was Kate Butley. Thank you very much. Right. We are actually going to talk about a lot of things. We're going to go pretty deep on some stuff. We're going to talk about Kate's life. We're going to talk about what it's like to be Kate, what it's like to be in the Church of England. What we're not going to talk about is what she was doing at 4 o'clock in the morning. Because anybody who saw that gold lame caftan last night knows exactly what she was doing. She was dancing, right? But for those who kind of know of you, have heard you on the radio, have maybe thought about buying your book, which you're going to try and persuade them to do in the next hour or so, when people go, "Oh, yeah, you're that Kate Butley," what do you say to them about who you are?
So I suppose you're asking kind of like for a one line bio, like you would put on your Tinder. I was going to say Tinder profile, but I probably shouldn't know what that is. I know, right? Don't Google it. It's not safe for work. I guess priest is probably the first one that I would say. Priest and broadcaster is usually how I introduce myself. But it took me a long time to be able to introduce myself as both of those things. So to shake people's hand and go, "Hello, I'm Kate. I'm a priest and I'm a broadcaster." And I think there's been probably a change over recent years because it was always, I'm a priest first and then I happen to mess about on the telly a bit. But increasingly, it's not that way around. So rather than being a priest who happens to be a broadcaster, I would say I'm a broadcaster that happens to be a priest.
And does that feel different to you?
Yeah, I think when I first gave up parish ministry and went into full-time media, touting my wares, I said I would give it 2 years to see if I could make a career out of it. And that was 7 years ago. And when I left full-time parish ministry, just a sec.
Yeah, that's right. She always knows where the camera is. Was that comment from down there? And if there isn't one, she brings her own.
The trick is to put your tongue in the roof of your mouth.
Is it?
You're all doing it now, aren't you? It's like saying the words pelvic floor in a room full of women. How was that? So what happened was... you still here?
Good. I'm here, yeah.
Great. So what happened?
I'm holding on.
Fabulous. So what happened was I did a flash mob that went viral on YouTube. We know about that. If you don't know about that, I did a flash mob at a wedding that went viral on YouTube. And then I got an offer from Channel 4's. We got an offer, Graham and I got from Channel 4's Gogglebox. And we went and did that for a bit. And what happened was telly stuff and radio stuff started coming in, because once they've worked out that you can string a sentence together and that you've got a niche. So, you know, there's only one other telly vicar, Richard Coles, and me. And so they were like, well, you know, this is a niche that you can, this is a hole you can fill. Then what happened was it sort of started gaining momentum, really. And I thought that we should probably give up full-time parish. But I had nothing to go to. I had no work. I didn't have a contract. I didn't have any of that stuff. And the story I told myself was it was all by luck. It was all by, it just all happened by chance, or divine intervention or whatever. But there seems to have been an element over the last couple of years of owning a bit of it, really, I think, is probably what I want to say.
Good. Because the truth of that is you were doing things like Pause for Thought and you were sort of plucked out by the radio gods to go and be a radio presenter, right?
Yeah.
And that wasn't luck. That was because of the kind of warmth that you have and your ability to engage with people. You know, you strike up a conversation with anybody in any place. I've seen it so many times. But also to communicate that on the radio as if you're just talking in somebody's ears. That's not luck. You're brilliant at it.
Sweet. That's very kind. Thank you.
Okay. That's true. What I'm doing, you see, is I'm trying to get her to cry now.
He's going to ask me something really mean. Yeah. I know what he's going to do. I don't trust him.
But I'm going to leave it now about 15 minutes.
Exactly what he's going to do.
What I do want to do is actually... go a little bit back to the beginning, because one of the reasons that people come to a thing like this is to go, okay, I know her, I've seen her, I've heard her, who is she? So tell me about where you're from, what your childhood was like, was it a happy one, how was it?
So I'm from Sheffield originally. Work very solidly working class family. I've got an older brother, older by about 4 years, and my mum was a school cleaner and the crossing patrol lady, and she cleaned the dentist surgery. She left school at 14, couldn't read and write, only learnt to read and write later in life. And my dad was a tool maker in steelworks. So, that's my background. Grew up in a terraced house. My mum had a massive family, loads of aunties and uncles and cousins. The idea that you could do a job that you enjoyed rather than just a job that paid your bills and made sure you could go to Torremolinos for 2 weeks in the summer and drink beer was just a completely foreign concept. You know, you work so you can spend the money. You don't work for enjoyment and fulfillment and all those kind of things. And then I was quite clever at school was what the difference was, I think. And I enjoyed learning. I really enjoyed being at school. I am short, ginger, round and a Christian. So, you know, I was the bullies didn't know where to start. Let's put it that way. It's like, ooh, what do we pick first? So that was fun. But I found my faith when I was 14. A classic evangelical conversion experience of, I remember the moment of from not believing in God to believing in God. And I remember having to go home and tell my parents that I'd got our Katie's Got Religion. I remember having, and that was, I think that was one of the hardest conversations I ever had with my parents, was telling them that I'd found my faith. And they honestly thought I was joining a cult.
Can we set the scene a bit? Yeah. Your mum and dad's names?
Margaret and Arthur.
Margaret and Arthur.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens? They're at home having their tea and you come in and you tell them I've got God. How does this work?
My dad was very worried that it was going to put me off my GCSEs and I should concentrate on my exams.
Good lad.
And that that Jesus was going to distract me from passing my maths. Honestly, that was it. And they thought I was joining a cult and they were really worried. And I'd got that fervor and new conversion. So I was just trying to convert everybody. You know, I'm in sales, I'm not in management. You know, so I was like just trying to flog the gospel to every single person who would give me 30 seconds of their time. It was an evangelical context that I came to faith in. So I was told, I remember being told that if my mum and dad didn't convert and pray the Journey into Life prayer, that they were going to burn in hell for all eternity and it would probably be my fault. So I needed to get them signed up as quickly as possible.
That's
abusive, right? Who tells a 14-year-old that your mum and dad are going to burn in hell unless you do something about it? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. Of course it is. How had it happened? I mean, where were you when
this
happened?
So Christian Union, I had, because I was academically more able than the other children that I'd come up from primary school with. I was put in a higher set than all my friends when I arrived at secondary school. And the nice girls in the higher set all went to church. So I went to church with them. And it did help that the vicar's son was quite cute.
Did you get anywhere?
Quite far. We had two kids together, so we did all right.
This is your current husband.
Yeah, this is the current Mr. Botley.
Very, very good. I'm just intrigued by that, you know, like that conversion thing. Was there a class element there?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there was definitely a sense of wanting to better myself, and that church was where the nice girls were and the good kids, and that there was something about being with us. And I remember one of my friends from primary school saying to me, "Oh, you don't want to be friends with us anymore because you're friends with the good girls now." And I remember that really, really vividly. Definitely a class element. And that's sort of gone through. You know, it's a weird, I work for the BBC and the Church of England. It's the most middle-class organisations I can think of. I'm a stranger in a strange land, you know, and I have said to me on numerous occasions, "Oh, you're actually quite bright, aren't you?" And what? So a Gogglebox producer said it to me. She went, because they make you like watch Newsnight and Party and all this sort of stuff. And I was talking about something about, I don't even know what it was, economic policy or something. And it was GDP. I was explaining GDP on Gogglebox because that's what you do, right? How did I get there? And the producer came in and went, that was really good, Kate. You're actually quite bright, aren't you? And I just went, what? And she knew she'd said something she shouldn't have. And I said, "Can I ask you, because I'm really interested, what made you think I wasn't?"
What did she say?
"Your accent." "Your accent. Of course."
Yeah. We're going to come back to class because it's really at the centre of what you do in a way now. But let's go back to that bright kid who was 14 years old, who'd snagged the vicar's son and was having the time of her life.
Look at the look
on that face, right? But also being bright and being sort of pushed forward in that educational way, I know myself from not a dissimilar background that that can be a tension, right? With your mates and with your parents.
Yeah, with my parents, my mum and dad had no idea. So basically I had to do GCSEs, A-levels, going to university, all without anybody else knowing how to do those things. So you think if you've got children who've applied for university, you went to university yourself, it has changed since you went, but you sort of know how it works, right? I didn't know anything about any of that. I didn't know how it worked. I didn't know how you applied. I didn't know, you know. I remember when I got my degree, my mum phoned me up and said, have you passed? Because that it's pass or fail, right? That's the only, you know. She didn't know what a 2-1 or a first or any of that stuff is, you know. And she used to ask me when I was at uni and when I was doing my master's, she would go, have you had a nice day at school? It's really sweet.
That's really
but
sweet.
But what you have to think is I had no way of knowing what any of that was. It was all no one had ever filled in a UCAS form in my family. I couldn't even go and ask like aunties or godparents or anybody because it wasn't part of our cultural experience.
So what gave you the drive and the confidence to do it?
I think partly being part of the church, really, you know, and that there were other people around that had were trying to shape, were doing that too. And I wanted to carry on being part of that movement. But also I went to youth theatre when I was 11 because my mum was the cleaner at the youth theatre. And during the school holidays, she didn't want to leave me at home. So she took me with her to the youth theatre that she cleaned at. And it was a council run. It was in the days when they had money and Socialist Republic of Sheffield that it is. Independence for Yorkshire. They paid for it. It was free. So there was all these kids off the estate and from my road who went down to the youth theatre and we only did classics. So at 11, I was doing Chaucer, Beowulf, Shakespeare. And I didn't know that that's not what you did because that was just what I went to. My mum cleaned there. And when we did Shakespeare, we learnt the whole play. You didn't learn just your part. So the first Shakespeare play I did was The Tempest and I was Ariel. But I didn't just learn Ariel's part. I learnt the whole play off by heart.
Every single line.
Wow. Right? And because our drama teacher had this thing. Don't ask me.
Hang on. your 14-year-old self is getting applause. Let's hear it.
So
well done, young Kate.
Thank you very much. So I learned it all off by heart because our drama teacher, our director said, you never know if someone's going to be sick or ill or I might. And she often would change her mind about who was playing parts. And I remember I was Ariel and there were lots of Ariels. It was like 10 people playing Ariel together. It's very experimental. And one night she went to me, I don't think you should be Ariel tonight. You're doing Prospero. And so I did Prospero. And it didn't occur to me that that wasn't just what you did. So Crucible, main house, age 12, doing Prospero on main stage.
Hang on, the Crucible?
Yeah.
That's big, right?
It's not just a snooker hall. It's actually a theatre.
I saw the Waterboys there. They were very good.
Oh, yeah. Good. Lovely.
Okay. So you're, you know, you are, I suppose, standing out from your mates, right? I mean, you've got new mates.
I wasn't born to blend in, babe, so...
No. Well, I was going to say, I mean, have you always been an outright show-off?
Yeah, pretty much. And I love it. And I absolutely, if you've not realised, I've monetized my bullshit, haven't I? Sign for bullshit. I've taken the very thing that, and my mum, God rest my mother, you know, God rest her. She was a wonderful woman. But one of the things, because she was a working class woman, all her status, all her purpose was through motherhood and being a wife and keeping a nice home and scrubbing your front step and making sure your nets were clean and that, you know, your baby never had food around the mouth, all that sort of stuff, you know. And she used to say to me, all the time, oh, Katie's such a dreadful show-off, like it was a bad thing. And telling yourself that you were beautiful and telling yourself that you were talented and telling yourself that you're capable, that, you know, that was not a thing that you were to do.
Yeah.
You weren't, it wasn't, you weren't to say that you were good at your job. You weren't to say that you were funny or clever or beautiful or talented or any of those things.
Yeah, I know this because this is the flip side of the story that we sometimes tell about, you know, coming from warm, diverse, creative, working class backgrounds, is that actually sometimes in that situation, you're getting chopped down, you're getting the piss taken out of you because you're clever or because you're different, right?
Yeah.
And so there, you've got to kind of escape that sometimes, haven't you?
Yeah, but I am from a big family of show-offs. I mean, in extended family. If I tell you in my extended family, I'm one of the quiet ones.
Lordy.
Ah, Tracy. Oh, my goodness. My cousin Tracy is a force to be reckoned with. We're big, loud, gobby, massive-bottomed Yorkshire women.
They like that. First, when we met, one of the first things Kate ever said to me was, you know, God made me a gobby egotist, and I'm doing the best I can with it,
yeah.
Right?
And that was one of the things. I mean, it won't surprise you to know that theological college was not the happiest 2 years of my life. People were very kind, people were very nice, but these were not my humans. Christians, eh? And what happened was, I remember the week I was getting ordained, and they send you off on this silent retreat to Lawnd Abbey. I love Lawnd Abbey. I love people. They're great, but it's not my bag, right? And I remember being so upset because all the way through my training, people had said, different people, and lots of them half-heartedly, sort of joking, had gone, well, you won't be allowed to do that when you're a vicar. You won't be allowed to wear that when you're a vicar. You won't be allowed to say that when you're a vicar. And I remember the week of my ordination just being so sad that I thought that the moment the bishop put his hand on my head, that was when I would stop being Kate. And it would be done. And I would have to water myself down and blend in. And, you know, I was told that the reason we wear robes is so that we're not noticed at the altar, so that we blend in. And I was like, that's not what I want to do. I don't want to blend in ever.
It's not actually true either.
You know, these
days,
I'm more me now than I've ever been.
Yeah.
I'm more me now than I've ever been. And, you know, sometimes people... I like being looked at, and I like being a show off, and I like being the centre of attention. And sometimes the people that say to me that I shouldn't be the centre of attention are the people wearing pointy hats and copes. Now, don't tell me they don't like being looked at too. You ain't wearing that because you don't want to be looked at.
We're coming to them. But at the minute, I want to just get a picture of what you were doing before you went for ordination.
Though. Okay.
Yeah. So you went to uni.
Yeah.
You played rugby, I think, at uni.
Yeah. Drank a lot of beer, played a lot of rugby. I was a hooker before I was a vicar. It's a good line. It's still a great line.
Don't encourage her.
They're supposed to encourage me. That's what they're supposed to
do. I've heard that one.
We're supposed to encourage each other.
I've heard that 100 times.
It's a good line, though. It's a funny line.
It is a good line. Go on, then. So you're a teacher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Secondary school teacher, Parson Cross Estate in Sheffield. Lots of kids called Carl with a K. Lots of kids called, Courtney and all that, all with a K. And working class. In fact, it's the estate my mum and dad met on and grew up on. So I taught at the school round the corner from where my mum and dad met and my mum's childhood home. So, just brilliant. And, you know, I remember all sorts of stories. I remember I was trying to sell my car and nobody wanted to buy my car. And so one of the lads, Robbie, said to me, "Well, just leave keys in it, miss. We'll get rid of it for you." Like it was nothing. And I went, "That's illegal." Robbie went, "Not really. We do it all the time." Brilliant. Absolutely hilarious. You know, there was one kid whose dad was the local drug dealer, you know, and I remember one particular time he was, I love this. The classroom I taught in 1950s building, big glass windows down one side. And his house was opposite my classroom window. And I heard this shout go up and they went, "Carl, your dad's on roof." And we looked out the window and Carl's dad had climbed out of the bathroom window and sat on the roof because the police were raiding the house. and he decided that was the safest place for me. So for the whole day, I was trying to teach RE. I was trying to do like five pillars of Islam or whatever it was. I don't know. And there was just this crowd, this SWAT team in the front garden going, come down. And I was going, I'm not coming down. Wait. Like absolutely brilliant. Absolutely, so much fun. He came down, they dragged him off and he got community service, I remember. And his community service was to be the crossing patrol outside school. It was the best crossing patrol we had in ages because nobody was like running under his lollipop because they wouldn't get the stuff they needed for the weekend, including the teachers. It was brilliant. And then Carl once, they left the keys in the, we were having building work done at the school and JCB in the car park, and the builders left the keys in the ignition to the JCB. And he's just driving it around the car park. Like, brilliant. I loved teaching so much. I never thought I would do anything else. I was awful at marking. I was terrible at prep, but I really loved being in a classroom with the kids. I loved going on residentials. I loved helping them cheat in their exams. You know, I'll tell you now. I mean, there are a few vicars in here that can give me absolution. I'll give it myself. There we go. Done. I helped every single child cheat in their GCSE RE exam without reservation. And I have no shame about it. I would literally walk past while I was invigilating and go, no. Like that. These kids needed a break. They needed a break. And one of the things I was most proud of with the RE teaching is, obviously, the reason I taught RE was because everybody hates it. So I thought I could be the best teacher they'd ever had really easily, because obviously it's all about me. And a little bit about Jesus, but only a bit. I loved it. And the group I loved most was the year nine lads on a Friday afternoon who'd been dumped in my room. And the first thing I did with them, a lot of these lads couldn't, you know, they never really learned to read and write properly either, and they had a really rough time of it. The first thing I did with them was teach them a magic trick and how to make balloon animals. That was the first lesson. So that they could then, and juggling, so that they could then do something that nobody else in the school could do, because they'd never had that experience of being the best at something and having a skill that they could show off and people be impressed by.
How did you know to do that?
Gosh, that's a good question.
At last.
How did I know to do that? I suppose because I knew what it felt like for people to have low expectations of what you might achieve and to feel good at something, to feel the best at something. I remember when I got head girl at secondary school and I was so thrilled to get that. And it, you know, it's just a little comp in Sheffield, but to get that, to be acknowledged to be the best at something, I love that feeling. Yeah.
So you've been head girl at school, you've gone to uni, you've come back and you're a teacher in your old estate. Margaret and Arthur are chuffed a bit.
They're so proud.
Oh, this is wonderful. And then Jesus messes it all up, right?
Well, I mean, the thing is about being called to ordination, whatever that means, is it's a bit like being a politician. If you want to do it, you probably shouldn't. It's that thing of enough people said to me, we'd like you to be up the front. You should have a go at preaching. You should have a go at this, you know. And I remember being, when I first came to faith at 14, I remember sitting and looking at Graham's dad in the pulpit and thinking, oh, he looks ever so like his dad, doesn't he? That's a bit weird and off-putting. Snogging someone who looks like your vicar.
At least it wasn't your vicar.
Yeah, true. Although he snogged his vicar, hadn't he? Graham snogged me, so that must be weird. I remember looking at Graham's dad in the pulpit and thinking, how do I get up there? How do I get up there?
Right.
So
right.
I remember that really
early
on.
Because you wanted what? You wanted the attention?
Well, I wanted people to look at me, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But we can dress it up as a holy thing if you want. But I don't think that's not holy. I don't think that's not holy. And I think one of the things we trip ourselves up about is that we go, oh, this holiness and not holy. That, never mistake holiness for snobbery.
Unpack that a bit more.
So I think sometimes we get a bit snobby about what we think is proper and what we think is holy. And actually, it's just snobbiness. It's just because it doesn't look like what you, how you would do it, or it doesn't look like what your experience has been, it doesn't mean that that's not got God in it. So a prime example is, you know, the silent discos in cathedrals that we've had recently.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a whole load of people kicking off about how that's not holy. Same people wouldn't be kicking off it with ballet, would they?
No, no.
So me shaking my backside to Taylor Swift in a cathedral is not holy, but that man in really tight tights doing Swan Lake is. Is that what you're telling me? Because I think both probably are, or not. Or maybe God just don't mind. And we're like, God's like that. Yeah, all right, whatever. Kind of got bigger fish to fry right now. I don't think she cares. Yeah, okay. So what happened was, clever, wise people said, we think you might want to explore ordination. So I did.
Okay, so you're going to explore ordination, but we hit class again here, don't we?
Yeah, because very much so.
Yeah, okay. Explain what you mean. Yeah.
Well, it just, you know, it's just a weird beast, the Church of England, isn't it? And they're all, you know, we're all very, I'm part of it, you know, the much, I don't know why sometimes, but I am. And it's everyone's very nice, you know, it's a different experience. I remember on my BAP report, it said...
What's that?
A Bishop's Advisory Panel. So what you do is if you don't know the process, you go and see people who are clever and stuff, and they ask you questions and they discern whether they think you're called to ordination. Then eventually they send you to what is a bit like the X Factor's judge's house with a whole bunch. Because the best way to judge whether someone's going to be great at talking to people who don't go to church yet is by locking them up in a country house with other people that already go to church. Like, it's so weird. These advisory panel things are so weird because there's like, I'd never been to anything like this. There's sort of 12 of us in this little country house thing, and people are watching you have your breakfast and they're going to ask you these questions. You've got a presentation to do and all sorts of stuff. And everybody's a Christian there. Everybody's already in the church. So at no point do they take you to like a supermarket or a pub and get you to like talk to a normal. So how do they know that, you know, you can talk to a normal? Do you see what I mean, though? Like, if I was in charge of it, I would take somebody to a supermarket and go, right, or take them to a pub. You can tell a lot by people how they buy a round, right? So go and buy a round. Let's watch you buy a round. How do you talk to the person behind the bar? How do you ask people what they want to drink? How do you manage that? Or anything like that, any kind of normal. But instead, they lock you up in a country house and ask you about theology. And I'm like, I'm not sure. That's important. Of course it is. But it's not the be-all and everything. And my BAP report said, we discern that Kate might be called to her indigenous people. Like working class northerners. We don't want to near those nice middle class people in the Cotswolds, for goodness sake. We discern she's called to her indigenous people.
That is outrageous.
It's outrageous, isn't it? Outrageous.
So you saw that report?
Yeah.
And you still went forward.
And also, they said Kate had a mediocre school career. I got 12 GCSEs, 4 A-levels. Mediocre school career.
Wow. Okay, so you...
Because they weren't all A's.
Were they not?
No, funnily enough. I got a boyfriend. I was doing a lot of snogging.
As long as that's all it was.
Yeah, well, evangelical, it wasn't, but we'll just say it was. We were all pretending, right?
Seriously, though, you saw what they were saying about you.
Yeah.
And you still went, okay, no, I'm going to do this.
And I still go into rooms like that. You know, what happens is when you get a bit of a, you know, obviously I've got a bit of a status in the church. I've got a bit of a, you know, role. And I'm a canon and all that sort of stuff. And so you go into rooms, and I don't use that stuff very often, but there are rooms I walk into where I know I need to introduce myself as Canon Kate Botley. Because that matters to them. They go, you're Northern. You know, there's still a lot of that. And a lot of people going, well, of course, I don't watch much television. You know, a lot of that. I love telly. I don't read. I'm here to flog a book. Read his, by the way. Buy his.
Yes, do.
Everything is extraordinary. It's a marvellous book. You know, I love telly. And you sort of made to feel a little bit sort of ashamed of stuff like that, really. Of course, I don't watch much. And it's fascinating. When I am on telly, it's always fascinating which people recognise you from, what they recognise you from. Yeah. You can tell a lot by when people come up to you and go, oh, you're off the telly, I saw you in. You can tell, you know, it's so funny because a lot of people in church circles go, I really enjoyed your winter walks on BBC Four. Like that. You go, oh, okay, like that. And it's, not, it's just fun. It's just, and then other people are going, oh, I thought you were great on Would I Lie to You? Or I thought you, I really enjoyed you on The Wheel or whatever. Yeah, most bishops aren't watching. When I did 8 out of 10 Cats, they were like, are you not worried about what you're going to say? Like, they're not watching it. They're not watching this.
No, I imagine they're not.
They're not watching this.
We're going to, in a minute, we're going to come to a question about how on earth you can still hang out with these people. You know that's coming,
right? Yeah, I know,
right?
That's coming.
Because there's other bigger issues. Coming. Yeah. But before we get there, so how did you go from being, we've talked about the flash mob. For anybody who doesn't know and wants to see that, that's a thing that happened at a wedding. Mm-hmm. Briefly tell us that for people who don't know that.
So Gary and Tracy getting married. Wanted something a bit different. Everybody wants their wedding to be the best wedding anyone's been to, right? So they said, would you do a flash mob? I said, that's a bit 1990s, but the Church of England's always a healthy 20 years behind any trend. So let's dance. So the music went, everybody dance. I danced, they danced. They put it on YouTube for the people that weren't going to be at their wedding, and it got 10 million hits. It went viral really quickly, and it was really scary. It was brilliant. I absolutely loved it, obviously. You're kidding me? People stopping me in the street for selfies and going, oh, we saw you. Brilliant. But it was really scary stuff.
What's scary?
It was scary because all of us, I was not braced for impact. So now when I do telly stuff or I'm on the raid, I know what it feels like. So I widen my stance. I know there's a wave coming. We did a program last couple of weeks ago for Songs of Praise that went out about Libby. I can't remember. Thank you. I nearly said Lane and then remember that's the bishop. Lizzie Lowe, who took her own life because she was gay. And we did. So we knew. So when we do programs like that for Songs of Praise and stuff, we know there's going to be complaints. We know that's coming in. And I brace myself for impact now. So when I'm on 8 out of 10 Cats, when I'm on anything, I know that if I say anything, most of the time I go under the radar, but every now and again you don't. But I wasn't braced for impact when the flash mob went viral, and all my details were public, my phone number, my email address, where I lived. And so within hours there was phone calls to the vicarage of people shouting and screaming and swearing at me, and you know, telling me I was a disgrace and that I was going to burn in hell and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, that's what you mean by impact. I mean, yeah, you know, I don't want to get intrusive here.
Yeah, but also the good impact, right?
Right.
So I remember the morning after the first Gogglebox went out, and nobody tells you. No, but in reality TV, I mean, TV by nature is exploitative, right? But it's consensual exploitation. We know when we watch it that it's not all true, right? It's not, what? I'm sorry to tell you this. It's not all true. It's like, it's entertainment. We're entertaining you. That's our job, right? Look,
there is no Graham.
No, there is a Graham. They're just not actually married. No, there is, yeah, so I love the slightly delay on the laugh of the signers. It's so great. I love your laugh. It's so great. So great. So funny. What was I on? So it's not all true. So I remember the morning after Gogglebox, nobody had told us, nobody had said, this is what it's going to be like to be recognised. This is what it's going to be like to have your photo taken, someone across the room take your picture without asking you if they can take a picture. This is what it's going to feel like. And nobody had talked about it. And I remember going to the park the next day and this family just turned and just pointed like that at me. And I just went, that feels so weird. Chapel Roan, if you know Chapel Roan, she came out this week, she did a TikTok this week that said, I am a random stranger in the street, stop taking my picture. And there's something that happens that tips over, and it tipped over quite quickly for us and for me, where you become owned in a way, which you've sort of consented to, but feels really strange. So I remember a man on a train got on the train, sat down opposite me at a table of four, and he looked up and he went, and I was ready for the chat, So I always, when anybody goes, oh, it's you, I will always go, I'm Kate, hello, and shake their hand. And then they don't say their name. They go, oh, I know who you are, like that. And I go, and you are? So because two human beings are meeting, and I'm not an exhibit in a zoo. And what happens is this guy sat down, he looked up, and he went, so I was ready for the chat, and he got his phone out, and he held it up, and he went like that. And then he put his phone back in his bag and carried on. And I went, have you just taken my picture? And he went, yeah, you're off the telly. And I said, are you in the habit of taking pictures of women you don't know on trains, on public transport without their consent? Is that what you do? And he went, oh, it's weird, isn't it? And I went, it's really weird. I did it the other week at swimming. I was swimming outside. I went on someone. I was on Instagram. Someone attacked me on a post. Oh, what's that? And someone had seen me at swimming and had taken a photograph of me getting in the water in my swimming costume and posted it on their Instagram. Look who I saw at swimming, at Kate Botley. Weird. It's weird.
Okay. So, but the obvious question is here. You wanted this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You wanted to be seen.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you. Discharge all your humanity, does it? You're a human being first. And I think one of the things that why I'm pleased to be a person of faith in on the telly and on the radio is to keep pulling it back all the time. That the people that entertain us, the people that make our music, make our telly programs and entertain us on a Saturday night are human beings first. We're not praying for Kylie Minogue, are we, at the front? And we probably should, because we have this narrative of they're rich and they're famous, so they deserve everything they get. Because they're not actually real people, are they? You know, I remember walking into church one Sunday. I go straight from doing my radio show straight to church, and I walked straight into church. I still had my BBC lanyard around my neck, and the person doing the intercessions at the front was praying against the evils of celebrity and the corrupt media culture. The beguiling nature of fame. And I was like, I'm literally stood here. We do a job. The people on your telly box are doing a job for you. They're entertaining us. It looks easy. It looks like it's not a proper job. Believe me, it's a proper job and everything.
And presumably, the dear old Church of England was massively supportive.
Oh, they were so thrilled.
Yeah. They sent in specialist advisors to help
they
you with
did.
It.
Yeah. Full counselling support. Yeah. They definitely didn't take my stipend away and tell me I had to move out. They definitely didn't do that.
They said, how can we work with you, Kate? We want to understand what you've got to say here. And of course, they, particularly some branches of it, absolutely loved your championing of LGBTQ plus
causes. Yeah, Connie Mills were thrilled about that one.
Yeah, well, it's easy then. It's all a happy ending then, isn't it?
No, this is uncharted territory, right? This is especially popular media. I'm not interested in doing the daily service on Radio 3. I don't want to do it. I'm not interested in, I want to do theology for Bella Magazine and This Morning. That's what I'm interested in doing, right? So I know my demographic. I know where I'm working for. So this is uncharted territory, really. You don't get many clergy popping up or people trying to do any sort of popular theology on things like loose women, do you? Really, by and large. You know, they are doing the daily service and that's brilliant. Someone needs to do that. I don't want to do it, but I'll do this. So I acknowledge that a lot of it, we'd not been there before. So they didn't really know what to do, really. And they didn't really know how to have those conversations with me. So a lot of the support in the early days, I had to get in myself. So I found other people that were doing the job and I asked for some of their time so I could go and talk to them. I got myself a really good spiritual director. I had some therapy. You know, I took my phone number, you can't get my phone number anymore, all that sort of stuff. I got a really good agent, all that kind of thing. Tried to do some protecting of myself. But then slowly, really, really slowly, because it takes them a long time, they kind of got on board with what I'm doing. They don't really want to get involved. They don't really want to manage it. But they won't stop me either.
The flip side of that is that during this time when you've become this public figure, the church has, as ever, gone through its troubles.
Yeah.
And some things have happened within it that I assume from some of the things that you've said, you might sometimes think, I don't know why I'm still doing this.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm still associated with these people.
Yeah.
What's, if somebody says, why are you still hanging in there? What do you say?
Because the telly's going to stop phoning one day and I might need a job. No, that's the cynical answer. Why do I stick with it? Well, because I've got faith, because I still, because it's, the church is broken but beautiful, isn't it? It's because it's us. Because it's friends, because it's family, you know. So when I look at the big picture, and when I look at the mess that we've kind of got ourselves into, and I look at the stuff about sexuality, and I look at the stuff about the way of safeguarding and all that kind of thing, it's so depressing. And then I go and do communion for Doris, and that's not depressing. That's really joyful. She always has good biscuits. And so on, it's like a lot of organisations on the ground. It's a beautiful, broken, chaotic thing that I still kind of want to. And I'm also an eternal optimist, Cole. I think I can change things. And I don't think things necessarily change by leaving them. I want to be part of it, right? And I will keep telling myself that.
We're going to come to some questions in a second. We're going to have a roving mic. Sophie is out there somewhere, going to help to organise that. What I do just lastly want to ask you, we're talking about the book, Have a Little Faith. And while you were writing the book, the question I was going to ask you really was, hey, you know, what did Margaret and Arthur think of this? Your parents have seen you become this figure. How did they feel about that? But then you lost your mum while you were writing the book.
She died, yeah. She didn't just wander off in Tesco, I think. See, that's a really weird phrase. You lost your mum. Yeah, we just don't know where she's gone. we put a shout out on the tannoy and everything. no, she's dead.
Some people do lose their mum.
Yeah, they do. They do. Some people, that's the right language. But when you talk to clergy about death, we forget that other people don't talk about it like we do. So I get myself into trouble all the time. Anyway, she died, and death's awful. It's awful. It's horrible. And I thought I knew death. I've had other people die that I've loved. Death's my business. I've done a lot of it, right? I've sat alongside of a lot of bedsides. I thought I knew death. I did not know that particular aspect of it. And my mum dying, I think there's something very significant about Margaret's my birth mum. I know that's not the case for everybody, but for me, it was really significant that where I grew had gone. Where I was made and where I grew was no longer in the world anymore. And the only way I can describe the death of my mother is I felt like I was tied to something, not in a negative way. I feel untethered, and she died halfway through writing this book, so that changed the whole chapter on death.
What would she say to you?
Yeah, I don't like that frock. what you got that on for? Your arse has got bigger. Those are all things that she would actually say. Oh, I'm so proud, Arcata. I'm so proud. One of the best...
Hang on. Did she ever say that to you?
Yeah.
So you knew that?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember a really significant day. I was asked to preach at Westminster Abbey, and I said to my mum and dad, do you want to come? Do you want to come with me? And I got, oh, do you think we can? And I went, yeah, of course you can come. Just come, it'd be a nice day. So I got them first class train tickets, got them on the train. And my mum was really quiet all the way down on the train. And I was like, what's the matter? And I went over and I said to her, are you okay, mum? And she was crying. And I said, what's the matter? And she went, what if I show you up? What if I show you up? And one of the things that I...
She couldn't, right?
No, of course she couldn't. She could never show me up. But it suddenly dawned on me how far the distance between how far we'd come as women in our family. That here I was with my mum, who can't read and write, and left school at 14 and was a school cleaner. Not that that's, you know. And she was going to hear her daughter preach at Westminster Abbey. And when I came down from the pulpit, what they do in Westminster Abbey is when they have a service, the seats are set up for a service. And then after the service, they clear the chairs away for the tourists coming in. So there's about an hour between the furniture being moved, which basically is all being a vicar is. He's just putting down go-pack tables and stacking chairs. So there was an hour between the furniture being moved for the tourists coming in and opening as a tourist destination. And the dean came across, or the verger, or somebody came across in a frock and said, Mr. and Mrs. Stevenson, would you like a private tour of the Abbey? And I watched my mum and dad walk off while I was getting out my robes and stuff and be shown around Westminster Abbey. And then I took them for champagne afterwards. And it was, you've made me cry, you sod.
Just to be clear, you cried at the beginning too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a joyful, joyful thing to do for them. And I miss her so much. But also, you know, I want to say out loud, because death is death. Surprise, surprise, it's coming for all of us. There's some stuff that's better now my mum's dead. And you're allowed to say that out loud. You know, there is some stuff that's easier and better that my mum's dead.
Like what?
What a wear. Yeah. What a wear. When I used to go to her house, and when I was on telly, I used to think really like, I don't think my mum will like this frock, I better not wear this.
And when you're on the telly?
Yeah, when I'm on the telly, yeah. So there's some stuff that's a bit easier and different.
So you're a bit more Kate?
Yeah, I think so. Just another little... Of course, I'm a different person. I ain't got a mum anymore. So you're bound to be different, aren't you? You can't be the same. You're forever changed by that experience. And there is some good stuff when people die. And you're allowed to say it. Because we don't, do we? We don't say that. We're not like, you're not supposed to say it. But there is some stuff that's easier.
There's a sense of relief, I suppose.
Yeah.
She suffered, right?
Yeah, she was really poorly. Really, really poorly. And this stuff, you know, and me and my dad, we had one of those working class relationships where the phone would go, my dad would answer and go, oh, hello, love, I'll just get your mum. So I'd never had a chat with my dad, ever. Because my dad went to football in the pub with my brother and I went shopping into Meadowhall with my mum. So I'd never had that. I didn't know me and my dad were like staring each other down going, right, what do we do now? Because we'd never had a we'd never had an extended conversation.
And now you have.
Yeah, we've built a whole new relationship and it's beautiful. It took us a while. Because I didn't realise that when somebody dies, it changes the context of all your other relationships in that network.
Well.
That's a talk in itself, right?
Isn't it? And do you know what? Because we were chatting away, we kind of...
We've not overrun, but we've... It was always going to happen.
We've reduced the amount of time for questions, but we're still going to get as many as we can in. Okay, so where is that microphone? Somebody... there, okay, great. So what have we got? Let's have a question down here, if that's all right. That person there, would you like to wave your hand again, just so we're clear? Okay, and then have we got one behind as well? And we'll go back to you in a second. Okay.
Sorry, just before we take any questions, this talk is recorded, so your voice will be on the recording.
Oh, no, is it?
Yeah. Surprise.
I said shit as well.
We'll be listened to by your bishop.
He said bullshit as well.
Okay, first of all, your dress is amazing.
Thanks, Babs. Yeah. It's got pockets.
I just wanted to thank you firstly for your authenticity comes through in everything.
I'm a big
you
fat
say.
Faker, love.
Honestly, everything you say, you can feel it. And you've talked about your humble background. You've talked about the differences in class and where you come up and expectations. What would you say to somebody who does feel that tug within their heart to ministry, but feels that they're not good enough?
That never goes away. Lean into it. You're not good enough. That's the whole point. The last perfect... I mean, my dad always says, I wasn't brought up in a religious family, but my dad always says, nobody's perfect. And he goes, no, they're not. Last perfect person in the world. They nailed him to a cross, so who wants that? it's one of my dad's standard lines. It's a great line. yeah, you're not, that's the whole point, is we're not good enough. And I think that what we do, and it's not just about priests, it's about anybody that we hold in public service and ministry, we expect them to be perfect and we expect them not to make any mistakes and we expect them to not be like us. And that's the whole point, that you lean into it. You're not good enough. Sorry, I'm not either. I'm awful. Yeah, we're not, are we though?
I think you made your point there.
Yeah? Good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. But you'll be brilliant at it.
Yeah, person behind white T-shirt, I think. Yeah, yes. Just, mm-hmm. There we go. Yeah, you will be brilliant at it.
You will be brilliant at it.
So I think for a lot of members of the public, you are the vicar they know.
I love it. Do you remember that Greenbelt year when I was interviewing the Archbishop of Canterbury and the person introducing it went, and now the most famous Christian in the UK and the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Better.
You haven't let him finish his question. Sorry. He might go, and what a sad indictment that is.
What an absolute horror of a human you are.
I'll say, funnily enough, my question is, how do you feel that you're the face of an organisation that is mostly run by Oxbridge graduates in their 70s?
Yeah. Why do I keep doing free PR for an organisation that is inherently homophobic and misogynistic, right? How do I feel about that? A bit overwhelmed, I guess, and unqualified, I think. And it's a weird thing to be the face of something that it sort of all happened by. I didn't see it coming, though. Do you know what I mean? They like built, so it wasn't like, yeah, it sort of built, really. I don't think I'm answering the question, Cole. Help me.
Is there a sense now that you can, because you were talking earlier about being more of a broadcaster than a priest,
yeah,
that you can step away from that?
From the priest bit?
Yeah.
No, because that's who I am, isn't it? That's your identity. The vicaring job is a different thing, but priestly identity, it's who I am. It's in, it can't be separated out. So I had somebody church-wise the other day said to me, when are you going back into proper ministry? And you're like, this is it. This is, I am more me now than I've ever been. And my vocation and calling to the media is not separate from my priestly identity. It's all one and the same.
We have a question down here.
Hello.
Hi.
And
you can ask anything, you know. You can just ask about telly if you want.
What, like what's your bra size?
Yeah, absolutely.
She said ask anything. It was the first thing that popped in my head.
I'm enjoying this already.
Thanks, Kate. I had just had a question of like what you might say to someone, say like 14-year-old Kate, if they felt called into the church, knowing that obviously we met through shared experiences of having a terrible time thinking that we couldn't be ourselves before ordination.
Yeah.
That's, you know, how
but
we that's how we met last year.
Yep.
What would you say to someone young, starting out, who, you know, is like you, or, you know, dyes their hair, has tattoos, all of that sort of stuff, if they're thinking, well, I can't follow this calling?
I think when you follow your calling, it's not just about, if we've been called to serve the church, then we have a duty to follow that through, because the church is richer through its diversity. That makes us better. And so, you asking about the Oxbridge educated people, I'm doing them a favour, and they're doing me a favour by us hanging out together, because it wouldn't be okay. It's not okay to have a church that's just full of one sort of people, is it? It's tricky and it's difficult, but we're a family, and it's hard when you don't. But none of us fit, right? That's sort of the point, I guess. But to my 14-year-old self, I won't say anything. She can make her own mistakes. I'm not helping her out.
That is such a rich psychological problem. Okay, we're going over here. Yeah, over there. Let's. Where I can't see anybody.
There's one.
Oh,
just
there's
here.
One there. Yeah.
I will come round. Bear with me a second.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I just need to climb over some chairs.
Is there some
small obstacle course? But I shall do it.
Brilliant. Thank you, Sophie.
Okay, what we might need to do here, Greenbelt, is be very Greenbelt and carefully pass this over for the sake of speed. So that person there with the blue hat on, I believe you had a question and you were the hand that was selected. Can I ask that we gently pass the mic? Thank you so much.
It's coming
so
to you.
So Greenbelt.
Here it comes. Here it comes.
Oh, look at that.
Well done, Greenbelt. Okay.
As a woman in ministry, you probably get compared to the Vicar of Dibley more times a day than you would ever wish to. Have you ever met Dawn French, and what did you say to her?
That is the content we're here for. Thank you.
Yes, lots of times. We could phone her if you want to. Do you want to pass me? That's a bit cool, isn't it? Yeah, we did a sketch together for Comic Relief a couple of years ago where we lip-synced to Lizzo, which was a lot of fun. And when the cameras cut, we were facing each other. I'm going to come here. We were facing each other like that, so just slightly too close for it to be comfortable. And gorgeous Dawn was like that. They went, cut, and then she went... So I have met her and I've snogged her. And it was great. You all right? Breathe.
Best green belt ever.
Do you want a little?
I think we've done that one.
Yeah, okay, great.
Let's move on. I can't remember anything. Okay, I think we've got one here. Yeah.
Hello. I have a question. I don't know if you'll be able to answer such, but at the moment, deaf and disabled people in church, the access and equality of society it's not fair at the moment. There's a real imbalance. I haven't been to church for several years now. I've left church for several years now, for various reasons. But one of the things is about the access and having permission out there for deaf and disabled people to go to church, including blind people, other disabled people, whether they're hearing and disabled or deaf. But is there a way that can be changed? I mean, I don't know if you can answer that. It's just, yeah.
I think if I could answer that, I would probably... I'd be sainthood by now, I would imagine. That seems like something that's a bit impossible to solve, really. But I suspect that the solution might lie somewhere in equipping people and giving the power to the people. One of the things I've learned about my faith is that it's always the opposite way around to how you think it's the steering into the skid stuff, isn't it? It's the opposite. So the rich are poor, the weak are strong. And so it's something about equipping and enabling people who perhaps have not had that power, giving power to the powerless, I would suspect.
It would really help if we had a church that actually did believe that every single one of us is precious. That would help.
Yeah. And not there to be fixed. And not there to be fixed.
Have we got time for one more, Sophie?
Yes.
That's a
not
no.
There to be, you're not but you're broken.
Sophie's saying yes with her mouth and no with her eyes. So I'm. So therefore, I'm going to go yes. Down there. Okay, thank you. Last one. I'm so sorry that we squeezed
so
it a
sorry.
Bit.
Kate, have you ever thought of actually running the Church of England?
Absolutely not.
I think you do a really good
job. No, because the last thing the Church of England needs is more Kate Botleys. One is more than enough. What it needs is more of all of us, doesn't it? You know, and that's not it. I mean, obviously I'm an egotistical maniac. I think I'm great. But the answer to the brokenness of the church is not more Kate Botleys, but it might be more Abigail Smiths or, you know, Cole Mortons or, you know, you're out, aren't you? You're out, mate. I know you're out. Or whoever you are, that's the answer. Also, I don't really do organisation. I love what I do because I can get away with things that I would not be able to get away with if I was official. So please don't ever put me in a pointy hat and a purple shirt. I look awful in purple anyway. But the Church of England, if I was in charge, the Church of England would be a smoking pile of rubble the next morning with me stood next to it going, oh, no, a big boy did it and ran away.
What a way to go.
It was like that when I found it.
We've come to the end of our time. Obviously, this whole thing has been a cynical marketing exercise. And there's a book for sale over there. Are you going to go over there and sign it?
Yes.
Okay. So
are you going to go over and sign yours?
Oh, yeah.
We'll stand next to each other and sign
our
books.
All right, yeah.
That'd be fun.
Sure.
Can someone get us a gin and tonic? or just a fab front with Mr. Whippy. No, I'm kidding.
Fab.
Should we have a fab?
She asked me, it's just about as we were going to go on, said, do you want a fab? And I was like, with that dress?
In these shoes?
Anyway, yeah. Right, shut up. We're going to go over there. Don't shut up. Don't ever shut up.
I'm a national treasure, I'll have you know.
Don't ever shut up. Kate Botley.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.